So, what if practice were perhaps very small? What if it were easy? What if it were just a slight, almost negligible effort? And what if it were worth doing anyhow? As we were chanting the gatha on opening the sutra, I received a great Dharma teaching from Melissa, who started out the chant. The Dharma is comparably profound. when John Tarrant was here a few years ago, we did this chant before his Dharma talk. And he said, well, it kind of makes a big deal of it, doesn't it? I mean, I guess we could also say the Dharma, manifestly obvious and completely out there, is readily perceived. There's a New Yorker cartoon. You guys know I can't get through a Dharma talk without one. Of a guy, it's probably me, a pilgrim standing between two signs. One is a sign pointing to the left, and it's big Las Vegas Times Square neon flashing lights, and it says truth. And then there's another sign pointing to the right that says truth. And what if the sign that we should follow is the quieter one? Master Hongzhi, in a collection called Cultivating the Empty Field, has some advice on how to practice in this way. Accord and respond without laboring and without hindrance. Everywhere, turn around freely, not following conditions, not falling into classifications, facing everything. Let go and attain stability. Stay with that, just as that. Stay with this, just as this. That and this are mixed together with no discriminations as to their places. So it is said that the earth lifts up the mountain without knowing the mountain's stark steepness. A rock contains jade without knowing the jade's flawlessness. This is how to truly leave home, how home leaving must be enacted. So our own version of that flashing neon sign, you know, each of our versions of that may be different. You know, maybe it is that. We either the relationship we can have to whatever we imagine that sign is, it is, we can have it whether it, we experience it or whether we just wish for it. So maybe we think it's pointing at some huge and deep and really just feel it in every pore experience of just the oneness of everything. And you know, you stick around in Zen long enough, and maybe you'll have that experience, and so you can go and find this big flashing truth, but it's unclear what to do with that. And or maybe you haven't had that experience, but you're sure that it's just going to be so mind-bogglingly beautiful that you spend all your time kind of wishing for it and going in that direction. And all of these things, or maybe that big flashing sign is pointing at a deep stillness, an experience of samadhi, a non-experience of samadhi. But falling down and staying there, in that emptiness, in that stillness, in that flashing light circus, however subtle it might be, is a detour. So Master Hongzhi says, accord and respond without laboring and accomplish without hindrance. How is it that we accord and respond without laboring in our zazen? When we're practicing the zazen of Shikantaza, this is a profound practice of not laboring. But even not laboring is too much. And accomplish without hindrance. What is it that we accomplish without hindrance? Right now, sitting upright, what is it that you can accomplish without hindrance? And it's just this moment of you, universe, mind, body, everything else together. This moment exactly as it is. You are already according without laboring. You are responding without hindrance. In our practice, we say to let come all that comes and to let go all that goes. Hongzhi calls this staying with this, just as this. But we separate out this and that. We separate out good practice from bad practice. We separate out emptiness from form. We separate out our likes from our dislikes, and we prefer just the this and not the that. But sometimes what we've got is that. And when that happens, the practice is to be with that. When that's gone and you've got this, the practice is to be with this. You never, ever, ever need to get anywhere. You never need to have any state of mind. This moment, this mind, staying with this, is that teeny, intimate, inward gesture of practice. And sometimes when we do that, it may open up for us and we can experience a kind of profoundly supporting love that permeates the universe, that supports us, that holds us. And that can come just from staying with just this as this. And then we grab onto that and think how great that is. But it passes away. And we all have a tendency to want to look past what we can actually see to the thing that we think ought to be there, or the thing that was there before, or the thing that would be there if only we were better, or we had different parents, or a better teacher. And that is a sure fire and a 100% reliable pointer that you're not looking at the thing that's right there, which is a desire to see something else or confusion. And so in the analogy, and so that's seeing mental formations as mental formations and seeing the mental formation that has arisen, not the mental formation that a arisen wish tells you you should look for. And the analogy with visual forms and formations, you know, is to be looking at that red chair and trying really, really hard to see the white table. But that's the red chair. You can turn and perhaps see a table another time. Everywhere, turn around freely, not following conditions, not falling into classification. Facing everything, let go and attain stability. This line, facing everything, is evocative of a line in the Song of the Grassroot Hermitage, in which it says, the vast, inconceivable source can't be faced or turned away from. This is turning around and turning around everywhere freely and facing everything. And as undramatic as this practice is, it is profoundly important and profoundly useful. This practice of staying with this just as this, staying with that just as that, is what enables us to skillfully encounter the difficult, provocative, emotionally charged, scary, anxiety-provoking circumstances of our lives, to be able to navigate those more skillfully, to be able to navigate those and stay true to being the person we mean to be, guided by our aspiration and our intention, and still take care of what needs taking care of, without getting caught and run over and kind of put on autopilot by our reactivity. So practice is not nothing, and truth is not nothing. And this is the paradox of Zen. And the beautiful thing about the Zen relationship to paradoxes is that we don't actually have to resolve it. It seems like a contradiction, but you don't have to pick between the two. You don't have to let them contradict each other. So, so it's easy to fall into a story of, well, if it's just being with this, you know, why do I have to bother? What am I doing? That isn't anything important. Why am I sitting here on this cushion? So that's a story you can tell yourself. That's a kind of karmic habit pattern of thought you can follow. But the other side that Zen holds out is, please do it anyhow. Please practice. It does matter. It is worthwhile. But not because it's special, not because it's hard, not because it's difficult, not because you need to get anywhere other than where you are. Letting both of those sides be true. And writ large, this is what we, this is called, this is also the absolute and the relative. And this is what the kind of longitudinal practice of the koan curriculum trains us to be able to move fluidly between, and shows us over and over again how we want to prefer form to emptiness, or emptiness to form, or how it's easier for us to see this one thing and call it emptiness. And the practice of koan study helps us to let form and emptiness each keep their own place, and to see that one is the very expression of the other. So, as we continue our day of practice together, I want to encourage you to notice both of those truth signs. The one neon flashy one that will cure all your ills once and for all, that will definitely demonstrate that you're a good Zen student. And the other quieter sign that points to this moment of body, mind, universe already overflowing with perfection. That is, this is already Buddha's life living itself out through us. So I'll end by just reading you Hongzhi again. Accord and respond without laboring, and accomplish without hindrance. Everywhere turn around freely, not following conditions, not falling into classifications. Face everything, let go, and attain stability. Stay with that just as that. Stay with this just as this. That and this are mixed together with no discrimination as to their places. So it is said that the earth lifts up the mountain without knowing the mountain's stark steepness. A rock contains jade without knowing the jade's flawlessness. This is how to truly leave home, how home leaving must be enacted. So please sit comfortably, and also Melissa and I would be very happy to take questions, observations, comments.
Yeah. I just missed what the second sign said.
Truth.
It also said truth.
Yeah. In little teeny letters. Little quiet board.
But there's another cartoon by the same cartoonist that has the same guy facing two signs, which speaks very much to me. One says truth, the other one says cheese and crackers. But that's my quandary.
But how wonderful that we don't actually have to make that horrible, difficult choice.
No, the truth of the cheese and crackers. That's right.
And how wonderful and liberating that is.
When even in the original cartoon, the truth and the truth, we don't have to make that choice either. Mm.
This reminds me of something I read about from Nagarjuna. Maybe you can disabuse me if I've got it wrong. But in Buddhist logic, there is no law of non-contradiction. It's only a special law of physical objects. If Josh is sitting there, Josh can't also be
sure
sitting over there. But with your pilgrim's two signs of truth, the law of non-contradiction, well, truth is here, well, then it can't be over there. But truth is not a physical object, so the law of non-contradiction does not apply. It can be in both places.
That's right. And The only... Yes. And that's what Melissa was pointing to. And when we encounter flashing neon truth, to encounter that just simply as flashing neon truth. And doing that is encountering it just as truth.
So I think Doug's question also points to something else that we want to be careful about in practice that I think all of Josh's talk was pointing to. Zen is not about ideas or about framing things in a certain way and saying, got it, ever. So we can read stuff, and if you read enough in Zen, well, for example, sometimes things just cut right through. If you're approaching everything from the mind of this is going to explain it to me and now I get it, then you'll find that there's a ton of contradictions in all the vast literature of Zen. Even in, for example, Does a Dog Have Buddha Nature? Later on, there's a koan where somebody asks the same question to Jiaozhou, and instead of saying mu, which means no, he says yes. So this is there actually is also the possibility of Josh being in two places at once. But this is the like upside down understanding. This is where Stone Woman dances and all the other crazy stuff that you encounter in these texts. So the real text, always, these texts are pointing to the text of this body in this moment. This is what we're really working with. We're working with not just our ideas, but every single moment. Everything that Hongzhi talks about turning towards is not just an idea, but it's the real fact of our life, which is messy and wonderful and terrible and changes moment after moment. So they all come together sometimes, and other times they don't. Sometimes there really is big truth, little truth, or truth and cheese and crackers, or cheese and crackers, or dogs and children. Thank you. You can go now. So this is really not a matter that you can ever grasp with the mind that makes things just so. It has to be lived into. And thank goodness we have all these different texts. They're all pointers. But there's no one thing. And I have to say, there is one thing. And that's how it really is. But don't believe us. Don't believe us. Or Hongzhi. Or anybody who tells you something. This is the text. So this is what we read.
So I have trouble with this not laboring and how that would match up with my own experience of my practice over my lifetime. I mean, even from a little kid, I was laboring for I had no idea what, but there's you know, still today, is to say that it's not about laboring. I can't imagine that, you know, my practice without that. That laboring. I mean, and I guess, you know, okay, so be with that, but it seems to be an important thing, you know, and to just say that it's that it's ease and just, you know, go with the flow and don't worry about it, doesn't really capture the experience that I have.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry if that's what came out of my mouth. I certainly didn't mean to say.
No, I'm not.
Go with the flow. Don't worry about it.
And I'm not trying to say that you did, but I mean, this is a problem that I, you know, an ongoing difficulty that you're both well aware of. and I have
it's trouble. Steve, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if it came out of your mouth. It came out of Hunter's mouth. Maybe sometimes somebody wrote this down. Who knows? But yeah, you can almost, can't you feel the quality of?
And I need that somehow.
Yeah.
I think.
Oh, and here's really a little bit what we've been talking about. There's the mind makes an inherent contradiction. That Hongzhou's not pointing to a contradiction at all. I love the little piece about the rock with the jade in it. You know, there's a quality. It's like a big. I don't want to say this in a way that makes it sound trivial. But it's almost like a big game we're playing here. Everybody in this room is completely awake and enlightened already. And yet, I think the reason we have to practice is we really don't know that. The rock really has the jade in it. It's a done deal. But we suffer. We really work hard to ignore that fact over and over and over again. And we can come up with good examples of why it's not true. You know, everybody in this room can come up with some reason, that something that says, that's just a bunch of bull. That's not the truth. And so there's this quality that we all, to come to that truth that Hongzhi knew, probably from what we know about him, in every cell of his body, he probably had to labor to come to the place of not laboring. Somehow, he had to see through it. Even the Buddha, we hear stories about him just doing all these things where he starved himself. And then he came to this middle way. So in a way, the laboring is it too. And then when it falls away, the great relief of seeing that everything that's ever happened has led us to this perfectly, means that we can begin to embrace that laboring quality with a very different attitude. I don't know why the dog only barks when I talk. But that's probably some pointer to what we're trying to say here.
And just because you can do it without laboring doesn't mean it's not worth doing.
Started as a question, I think.
Well,
then it evolved.
For me, it was a question you answered.
You answered it yourself.
Yeah.
Thank you, Adrian. Nick?
I just wanted to make a comment. One of my old teachers addressing this, it was actually an interview, but I said the love of Zen practice is with immense effort understanding what is trivial to a six-year-old child. And I think that's a part of the deal. It's obvious, but it's obvious. And it's obvious if you don't know too much. But with a lifetime of accumulation, somehow it's not so obvious. And that's why I spend my time. One reason I'm on my cushion.
It's clear and apparent to a six-year-old child. It isn't trivial for any of us. This is a profoundly non-trivial practice. This really is. This practice that is all of that is the matter of life and death. And we don't have to labor to bring it forth.
And even though it was obvious to the six-year-old, the one now has another relationship with it because of everything that's happened between that moment and this. Did you have a question?
I was just about that it seems like laboring in all these other facets of my life, like working really hard gets me a pat on the head. So it sort of reinforces that value, and to drop that and just sit on the cushion for the joy of sitting on the cushion is a very entirely different experience.
It's the same in koan practice. Some people labor with koans, and some people just hold them more lightly. But it doesn't make any difference because you just get another koan. And so there's almost always a moment when somebody working on koan practice gets that. And then the laboring changes quite dramatically. It's like, whatever, I could be with this one for the next 20 years, or I could be with 4,000 over the next 20 years. But here's the practice. So every form of practice, shikantaza, koan practice, breath practice, many other practices that we could do and do, they're all leading us here. And we've been here the whole time. And that's almost the most important part, I think, that some people begin to recognize that. And then arrive at the place we've always been. It sounds easy, but it's not so easy because of all the accumulations that Nick was talking about. And it's really easy. And what have I left out? Easy, not easy. Not easy,
neither.
And
the dog didn't bark that time.
I know, I think he's moved on to another koan. Thank you.